webinar case study. As you know, in 2018, I started a webinar case review series where I cover my favorite neurotransmitter case on a monthly basis. And last month we had Julia's case that Dr. Smith reviewed, a postmenopausal female with symptoms of hormone imbalance. If you haven't seen it, check it out. And this month I'll be covering Loretta's case. So Loretta is a postmenopausal female with breast cancer, and I'll be talking about her neurotransmitters and diurnal stress hormones. And for the first time in this case webinar series, I'll be talking about elements and heavy metals. So stay tuned. So this is Loretta. She's postmenopausal. She's 62 years old. She has breast cancer and a lot of symptoms. She's very symptomatic. The big ones are depression, anxiety, stress, and here's where I show how the information she wrote down in her requisition form with breaking out each symptom specifically, how that translates at the bottom into groups of symptom clusters that we then evaluate to when we're looking at each patient. And you can see that she has lots of red bars, so she has obviously a lot of moderate and severe symptoms that are affecting her well-being. So these are the symptoms she specifically indicated, and there are a lot of mild symptoms that include menopausal type symptoms like vasomotor, like hot flashes and aches and pains and things like that. She has quite a few moderate symptoms that have to do kind of that mental health mood symptom imbalance, and then severe symptoms. And one of them is breast cancer. She's had a long history of breast cancer. And with that, she has rapid aging, bone loss, allergy sensitivity to chemicals, and OCD. So let's talk about breast cancer. I got this information on breastcancer.org. So if you're interested in learning more, please go ahead and visit the website. It's comprehensive and you can learn a lot of things, but these are the bullet points that I found to be important to discuss and relevant for the purposes of my presentation today. So 1 in 8 women will develop invasive breast cancer. So what does that mean with regard to numbers? In 2018, 266,000 new cases of invasive breast cancer are expected to be diagnosed in women in the US alone. Staggering. That's a really high number. Breast cancer rates are higher than those for any other cancer besides lung cancer, and approximately 85% of breast cancers occur in women who have no history of breast cancer. So they no family history. So that means genetic predisposition only plays a role that is a small role, but the majority of women that are going to develop breast cancer are not necessarily predisposed genetically. So this is a list of factors that can affect breast cancer, and I broke them up into two categories. The first half is the quote-unquote hard factors. So there's things that a woman can't do anything about with regard to developing breast cancer. So things like family history, age, early menarche and late menopause, age of first pregnancy, high breast density, estrogen dominance, so not necessarily producing enough progesterone to offset estrogen and inappropriate estrogen metabolism, so not methylating estrogens very well, as well as genetic predisposition, of course. And then there are soft factors. So these are factors that are more or less controllable by the woman. So things that can be affected by lifestyle. So alcohol use is a contributing factor to developing breast cancer, smoking, obesity, night shift work. We all know that disruption of circadian rhythms is very stressful for the body. Stress, and I'm talking about stress, you know, like night shift work or stress, everyday stress of, you know, life, basically. Environmental exposure to toxins, such as heavy metals, which we'll be talking about today. BPA, as well as oral contraceptives. So this is a diagram that I got from Dr. Zava's book that he co-wrote with Dr. John Lee. This is a estrogen matrix and breast cancer risk. And it shows that there are lots of different factors that interact in complex fashion with one another to contribute to breast cancer. You can see that estrogen is the common denominator. Well, except for we know that estrogens are essential for women's health and well-being, for the health of our cardiovascular system and bones and skin and brains. So in reality, breast cancer really has to do with an inappropriate estrogen metabolism. So this talk is not going to focus on estrogen metabolism, but rather on the factors that can contribute to inappropriate estrogen metabolism and oxidative stress. And I'll be talking about heavy metals. And this is a slide before we cover any of Loretta's labs. I wanted to show you why am I talking about breast cancer at all? Well, I work in a laboratory that was founded by a researcher who was publishing articles in Science, which is one of the most elite science magazines out there. He was publishing articles about breast cancer since the 70s. So Dr. Zava is definitely a world expert on breast cancer, and I'm happy to be part of his laboratory where I can talk about complex cases and have the expertise of my colleagues that I can contribute as well. So before we go into the labs, let's review stages of breast cancer. And it really breaks down into three, well, simple stages. Initiation, which starts with DNA damage, promotion, which is tumor progression, and then progression, which is invasion and metastasis. But don't get me wrong, the processes in the body are not simple. They involve complex interactions between various systems and lots of signaling events and mechanisms going awry. But for simplicity of talking about breast cancer, this is how we decided to present them. So jumping into Loretta's results, we're going to start with her elements results, so urine and blood spots. In urine, we see elevated bromine, elevated arsenic, and elevated mercury. So arsenic and mercury are considered to be heavy metals, and they play a big role in contributing to initiation of breast cancer, and we'll review how in the next few slides. And then in blood spot, we're seeing low zinc, which is a big red flag because zinc is protective against heavy metal toxicities. We're seeing just about low magnesium. It's in the low normal range. It's just above the cutoff for low. Selenium is low. Selenium is huge for detoxification events, and women that have low selenium tend to have a lot of oxidative stress and an inability to detoxify if they have heavy metal exposure. So the background of high arsenic and high mercury at the same time having selenium and zinc being low is not favorable at all for anyone, especially for patients with breast cancer. And then you can see that her mercury and blood spot is also really high. So why is that bad? Well, let's explore some mechanisms. So high mercury is, we all know that it's bad. You know, mad as a hatter, those are historical instances where people were accidentally exposed to high mercury, which made them go mad. But why really is mercury bad, especially in the background of low selenium? Well, high mercury propagates oxidative stress. So that means peroxides are up, reactive oxygen species are up, lipid peroxidation, protein oxidation is up, which contributes to mitochondrial injury. Well, what does that mean? Well, I put together this slide to explain exactly why reactive oxygen species are bad. Well, first of all, they're bad because they're reactive. They can bind to other molecules and rip electrons out of them and oxidize them. So that's bad. But here's a diagram of kind of a step-by-step mitochondrial destruction mechanism. So increased reactive oxygen species because of increased mercury and low selenium, increased glutamate uptake inhibition. And on the left, I brought up a diagram of glutamate. This is where it fits into the context that I will be discussing. Glutamate is a major excitatory neurotransmitter in our body and in our brain. It's made from the amino acid glutamine that comes from the TCA cycle or the Krebs cycle. And glutamate is metabolized to GABA, the major inhibitory neurotransmitter in our body. So what happens when glutamate uptake is inhibited by reactive oxygen species and cytokines that the reactive oxygen species stimulate? Well, increased glutamate means that it will persistently stimulate its receptor, NMDA. What's so special about NMDA, you may ask? Well, NMDA is an ion channel. So when the receptor gets persistently stimulated, it gets opened up and allows lots of calcium to flood the cell. And calcium has to be very strictly regulated. And if there's too much calcium inside the cell, that high intracellular calcium will also stimulate a storm of calcium into the mitochondria, our powerhouses of the cell, which will increase mitochondrial activity and lead to loss of redox control. So basically, mitochondria have these action potentials. They have ion sequestrations on either side of the membrane that creates that action potential. And they work by allowing protons to flow through the channels, transporters in the mitochondrial membrane. And that's how it basically downstream effect leads to generation of ATP. And when they don't have that redox control, they kind of go awry and they can't produce enough energy. So this loss of redox control leads to mitochondrial damage. Mitochondrial damage leads to even more reactive species, reactive oxygen species generation, which then starts propagating a vicious cycle of oxidative stress and toxicity. And what do increased reactive oxygen species do? They damage DNA. They actually physically break up DNA, so they mutate it. That's not good. Do you remember why DNA damage is bad? Well, that's the first stage of breast cancer. So for a moment, let's talk about this oxidative stress. So you see how it's destructive. Let's talk about what it is. What is oxidation? Well, oxidation is destruction, but it's a really good event. You have to have enough oxidation. For example, fruit ripening is oxidation. You go from green bananas to yellow bananas that you can eat to then rotten bananas that nobody wants to eat. That's oxidation. On the right is a picture of a ship I took on one of my trips to Oregon coast near Clatsop Bay. And I was a little disappointed to find out that it was not a pirate ship. It was actually a cargo ship coming from the UK delivering wheat to West Coast. And in 1906, on November 13th, the ship went through a big wreck. There was a huge storm. And on the left, you can see that it got destroyed. This is the picture on the left of the ship a couple of days after the tragedy. And thankfully, the crew survived. It was November 13th. But it was not a Friday the 13th. All the people got off safely off the ship, but it got destroyed. And you can see that 100 years later, the ship is just about gone. This is oxidation. Exposure to a lot of sun, salt, water. It's destroying the ship. So in relation to human health, oxidation is also a very normal part of our everyday life. Oxidation is aging. But a lot of oxidation, inappropriate exposure to oxidation, actually speeds up our aging. And oxidation by itself is a process of loss of electrons, right? So you're losing electrons in the process and become oxidized. So the molecule becomes reactive and it can inappropriately react with other molecules out there. The opposite of oxidation is reduction, also called oftentimes antioxidant processes. But it's in chemistry, it's called reduction. And reduction is gain of electrons. Reduction reduces the effects of oxidative stress. So antioxidants or reducing agents actually slow down aging. So that's the context for you as far as human health goes. So what's a really good reducing agent? Well, glutathione. Glutathione is produced in our body, and it's a very powerful antioxidant because it's a very powerful reducing agent. So to make glutathione, our bodies have to start with homocysteine, yes, termed quote-unquote the bad guy, but homocysteine is a very important intermediate that's coming out from the folate methylation cycle and feeding into that glutathione formation pathway. And it's a stepwise formation of glutathione with the addition of glutamate and glycine along the way. And what glutathione really is a tripeptide. That means it's made from three amino acids, glutamate, cysteine, and glycine, and it's the most powerful antioxidant we have in our body along with methylation. So the main role of glutathione in our body is detoxification. It is really good at destroying toxins, at protecting our body by reducing things, and therefore reducing the effects of oxidative stress. So on the right, you can see that it has lots of different other roles, but the main role, all of its roles have some form of detoxification mechanisms associated with it. So let's talk about oxidative stress in terms of this model. So with oxidative stress, like I mentioned, we have a lot of peroxides. We have a lot of reactive oxygen species. We have lots of heavy metals, lipid peroxides, protein oxidation, et cetera. Well, thankfully, we have glutathione that is really good at detoxifying events. So it reduces oxidative stress. And in some cases, it can reverse it up to a certain extent. However, when the body experiences a big burden from heavy metals, which if you think about it in terms of fish or piranhas, heavy metals devour glutathione and make it go away. And what happens when the body loses glutathione? It loses its defensive system. It no longer is able to protect itself from all of the toxins and all the burden that comes with oxidative stress. So now is a good way to bring us to Loretta's neurotransmitter results. Neurotransmitters play an important role in how the body perceives stress, to free radicals, chemical stress, heavy metals, and things like that. So with Loretta's results, we're going to take a look first at her numbers, which a lot of these look high, outside of the range, or high normal that are within the normal range, but kind of the outside of the optimal range. So she's running yellow. I do the analogy of the green light, red light. Well, green light is when you're within the optimal range. Yellow light is when you're outside of the optimal range and kind of nearing that red light zone when the symptoms become very acute. I like to break out neurotransmitter pathways and look at them separately. If you've watched my webinars before, but here I wanted to look at her neurotransmitters collectively because this picture paints a neurotransmitter pattern picture for somebody that we would call brain on fire or brain and body on fire because she's running high on most everything and that can't possibly translate well into symptoms that we saw earlier. But let's talk about her glutamate, GABA, and glycine first. I usually start with serotonin, and that's how we usually start analyzing neurotransmitter results. But in this case, I would like to talk about glutamate. And if you remember glutamate, that's a really big deal in oxidative stress. It's an important excitatory neurotransmitter. It ensures that we have enough of that fire to keep us going, but too much fire, too much glutamate can be a bad thing. Glutamate is also important for forming glutathione, as you remember, and I include right here. But I wanted to mention something real quick. So in the diagram before, I showed you that oxidative stress can inhibit glutamate uptake. in this particular patient, I was shocked to find out that she didn't have high glutamate, and her glutamate results were actually normal in the light of everything else that was running high. And so I took a little bit of time to think about this and what could be going on. And this is what I think is going on. And what I want to say is, don't be fooled by the normal glutamate results. So remember how glutamate, its uptake is inhibited into tissues under high oxidative stress conditions. Well, to show up in urine, glutamate has to be taken up through a transporter into the kidneys. It can be high in the circulation and in the brain, but in order to be eliminated in urine, it has to go through that transporter in the kidneys. So that's what I think is going on with this patient. Her glutamate is showing up normal in the kidneys because the transport is inhibited by the high amount of oxidative stress. And we know that she has a high amount of oxidative stress because she has high arsenic, high mercury, low selenium, and low zinc. So that's what I think is going on. We also see high GABA, which indicates that a glutamate level was high, elevated at some point. GABA can also play a role in the adrenals to regulate high norepi and epi response. I will be addressing that in a later webinar, but for now, high GABA usually indicates an elevated glutamate response, not in the so distant past, and it also can be high in response to regulate norepi and epi release from adrenals. And glycine is high. We see high glycine in patients that have a chronic demand for B6 vitamin that are depleted in B6. One word about glycine is that it does regulate NMDA receptors. If you remember, NMDA receptors is what glutamate binds to increase that calcium concentration in the cell and start that chain reaction of mitochondrial damage. So glycine binds to the NMDA receptor to modulate it. So we know that a few of the glutamate system components are dysregulated in her case. Next, I want to cover her serotonin results. And with that, I would like to say that when estrogen is low, serotonin can suffer. And what do I mean by suffer? Well, in menopause, when estradiol levels are low and a patient is not on HRT, we oftentimes see the serotonin result, the precursor result, the actual neurotransmitter, to be in a lower clinical range than its metabolite. And that makes sense because estradiol is very nourishing to serotonin. It actually works very hard at inhibiting serotonin degradation by slowing down the expression of monoamine oxidase A. And if you don't have enough estradiol, which we don't have the result for, but assume that Loretta does not have a lot of estradiol because she's postmenopausal, she's 62, and because she has breast cancer, it is likely that she doesn't have a lot of estradiol around, that her MAO levels are higher, burning up through serotonin and inactivating it to 5-HIAA. And another interesting point is that if you remember from her blood spot elements results, the copper value was in the normal range. However, we're always looking at copper and zinc together as kind of a unit, and we want to make sure that the zinc-copper ratio is balanced out properly. So although her copper is normal, her zinc is low, which basically creates a high copper, functionally a high copper environment. And we all know that copper is a cofactor for monoamine oxidase. Yet, you know, the loss of estradiol could be stimulating monoamine oxidase expression, and then that higher copper could be potentiating what MAO is available to potentiate, thereby burning through serotonin yet again. Next, we have her histamine results. She's running high, which we tend to see in depression and low libido. But in a lot of patients with allergies and sensitivities to chemicals, I have an article here talking about gastrointestinal food allergies and high urinary histamine levels. And with high PEA, we typically see a lot of stress, just mind racing, inability to sleep, the severe anxiety, being caught in this downward spiral of not being able to have a handle on your life. That's kind of the high PEA phenotype that we tend to see when testing neurotransmitter patients. And last but not least, I want to talk about her catecholamines and norepinephrine and epinephrine and her norepinephrine results. And before I do that, I did want to bring this diagram to talk about the adrenal gland. So adrenals are very important for our bodies because they are the body's stress responders. And of course, they're part of the bigger picture of the HPA axis, but we're going to talk about structurally about adrenals because they're the ones that produce and release stress chemicals. So on the outer layer, I guess in the middle layer of the adrenal gland, we have glucocorticoids. They're produced from the cortex, and there are long-term stress responders. The short-term stress responders are epinephrine and norepinephrine. The medulla of the adrenal gland is predominantly releasing epinephrine. That's also called adrenaline or our fight or flight hormone. So when you see a saber-toothed tiger, you gotta run. Those guys, epinephrine and to a really small extent, norepinephrine coming from adrenals, are at the heart of our survival as a species. So cortisol doesn't come for 15, 20 minutes until the stress response has been established. Epinephrine is what allowed our ancestors to run from danger, from real or perceived threat. And then higher epinephrine levels gave signal for cortisol to be produced. And that what gave energy and wits to sustain a longer stress exposure. So that's kind of the stress system in a very basic nutshell. The cool thing about cortisol is that it's also under circadian regulation. So the clock genes in the suprachiasmatic nuclei regulate cortisol expression and has this wave-like pattern distribution throughout the day. So it starts out low in the morning, and then about an hour after waking, it will rise and be highest that it'll ever be during the day, and then it gently falls and continues to decrease towards the evening. Norepinephrine and epinephrine also have diurnal patterns. However, unlike cortisol, they don't have circadian regulation component. They're just our responders to stress, right? So this, and I'm not just talking about, you know, stress of being confronted by a rude driver. I'm talking about stress of waking up, getting out of bed, going to brush your teeth. To your body, that's seen as change in homeostasis. So that's how I define stress. So norepi and epi are low at night, or you want them to be low at night, and they rise in the, during the day to allow us to have sufficient blood pressure, glucose regulation, and ability to make it through the day, and then they fall at night. I hope, hopefully they do. So like I mentioned, the predominant product of the adrenal medulla is epinephrine. Adrenals do produce a really small amount of norepinephrine. The majority of norepinephrine that we see in urine is actually coming from the sympathetic nervous system. But a small amount of norepinephrine that is formed in the adrenal can be released and then taken back up and then metabolized into norepinephrine. So in a way, norepinephrine is the adrenal product of norepinephrine metabolism. It's sort of an index of adrenal norepi production. And then epinephrine, which is very similar structurally to norepinephrine, not necessarily always in function, but structurally, it's almost exactly the same guy, except for epinephrine has that methyl group on the very end of the side chain, you can see. That's what the MT stands for, methyl transferase. That's how adrenals make epinephrine from norepinephrine. While this enzyme, PNMT, converts norepi to epi, well, the cool thing is that glucocorticoids, like cortisol, control PNMT expression and levels of epinephrine. So with sustained high levels of cortisol, you can expect that cortisol to signal potentiation of PNMT expression in higher epi levels. Well, we haven't covered Loretta's cortisol levels yet, so why don't we do that? This is what her cortisol picture looks like. Cortisol and cortisone can be interchanged with one another with regard to, they can be converted back and forth by 11 beta hydrosteroid dehydrogenase. Type 2 converts cortisol into an active metabolic cortisone, and then type 1 can convert it back to cortisol. You can see that Loretta's cortisol is extremely high. It's off our charts. And it's high at night. We know that by looking at her very first morning collection. And in urine, you're not looking at real-time production. That's more saliva assaying. But in urine, you're collecting whatever is happening to the body since the last void. So the first collection that we see with high cortisol signifies that all of that high cortisol was produced at night, interfering with her ability to sleep and contributing to her anxiety. You can see that since the first collection, the second morning collection also has high cortisol, so her cortisol remains high in that morning. And then when you see cortisol fall in the evening towards dinner time and bedtime, they seemingly look normal. But if you look at cortisone, they're also really high in the evening and bedtime. So even when cortisol looks fine, you know that it wasn't, because her body was making a lot of cortisol, just converting it better in the evening and at bedtime. And this is unfortunately a very classic breast cancer cortisol pattern. A lot of breast cancer patients that we test do have exceptionally high cortisol levels like this. So this is a summary slide, kind of pulling it all together for Loretta. Her symptoms, which is main symptom of concern, is of course the breast cancer that she's lived with for years. Also a lot of mood symptoms with depression and anxiety naturally, and a lot of symptoms of hormonal imbalances, which you would expect in breast cancer. Her stress hormones are really high. Her cortisol is off the charts. And unfortunately, she has this exposure to high mercury in the background of low selenium, where the body is struggling to detoxify all the heavy metals and oxidative stress that's happening. And her neurotransmitters are mostly running high. So what can she do? It's definitely important to consider the type of patient that you're addressing. So somebody with breast cancer has to be approached with caution, of course. And what's really important is to lay a general wellness foundation to be able to support them. And what am I talking about? Well, the general wellness recommendations are focusing on supporting sleep. That's kind of the number one point of allowing this patient to sleep so her body can heal. And that may include lifestyle interventions like mindfulness, introducing anti-inflammatory diet, yoga, and biofeedback. Also, a part of this foundational support would be introducing those key elements that are so important for helping our body to detoxify. Selenium, I should have mentioned this when I was talking about glutathione, is actually complexing with these antioxidant systems with our body and allows these enzymes to function and produce active species of glutathione. So selenium and zinc would be very important for Loretta. Magnesium, introducing magnesium and elevating her levels to somewhere more within the middle of the range would be good for her mood and kind of overall cognition. Magnesium can be very sedating and calming. Introducing glutathione and acetylcysteine as a precursor to glutathione. Alpha-lipoic acid for her mitochondrial health. A lot of different antioxidants in form of fish oils, and EPA and DHA and things like that. Bioflavonoids, polyphenols in general have been shown to have really good antioxidant properties in general, but in breast cancer cases specifically. So one such example is resveratrol, but it doesn't stop at resveratrol. Also introducing HPA axis support for a really, really high cortisol. So there are lots of adaptogens out there. Some of the really mainstream popular ones are ashwagandha and rhodiola, holy basil. But Dr. Smith actually mentioned to me that shatavari or amla is very gentle, and that might be an option if this patient's not responding well to kind of the more well-known adaptogens. And then once all of those foundational support elements are brought into place, that's when you can expect your patient to respond to any sort of other treatment that you might want to introduce to her. So phase two support would probably need to include retestin neurotransmitters. Her neurotransmitters were so high, and I feel like those results are very reactive to some of that oxidative stress and high cortisol that's happening. So I bet her neurotransmitter patterns and levels will change in response to some of these foundational therapies that are introduced. L-theanine may be introduced as well. It's a really great modulator of dopamine, serotonin, glycine, and GABA. It also helps allow the brain to switch from the task-oriented beta waves to more mindful alpha waves that people experience in yoga or meditation. And Bacopa is a really great agent that can help modulate neurotransmitters as well. There's lots of options, but this is kind of the general picture of a protocol that might be worth considering that our docs and I came up with for Loretta. And that concludes my Loretta case. And next month, stay tuned, I'll be talking about Jack's results. He's a veteran with PTSD who is 48 years old. And I'll include his urinary metabolites and diurnal stress hormones. Thanks for listening.